This is the homily for the second Sunday in Ordinary Time, 2023, at St. Anselm's Abbey. The readings for the day's Mass were the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 49, verses 3 and 5 to 6. The first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. And the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 29 to 34. The homilist was Father Gabriel Myers.
2023, Year of Matthew, Jesus' Teacher. 2024, in the Catholic Church and many other Christian churches, will be the Year of Mark, Jesus as Man of Action. Last year, 2022, belonged to Luke, Jesus as Healer. So why on the second Ordinary Sunday, which since the first Ordinary Sunday is always Epiphany or Baptism, why on the second Ordinary Sunday in all 3 years do we hear from the Gospel of John? Simple answer, the lectionary editors, like me, maybe like you, don't really want to let go of Christmas, even though now most of the decorations are down. Yet we don't want to leave behind that special glow. Yet somehow, each January, we must and do. Matthew's second Sunday, the Gospel just read, has John the Baptist highlighting what really happened in Jesus' baptism. Mark's second Sunday has two of John's disciples leave him to follow Jesus. Not very loyal. Each of these I see as really minor connective tissue to what the second Sunday really wants to give us, which is the third facet of the Epiphany, the second luminous mystery, the miracle at the wedding at Cana, which is not aimed at brides and grooms or even married people, but aimed at anyone who is spiritually thirsty. Maybe it is aimed at you. So I'd like simply to share a few thoughts about the Cana miracle, which, by the way, does not show up at all in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. In each of those Gospels, the first miracle is the exorcism of a demon at a synagogue service on a Sabbath morning, which, of course, couldn't happen here. Or maybe our demons just aren't so obvious. We are less willing to show them than characters in the Gospel. Only John, the beloved disciple, gives us the miracle at Cana. John's Gospel, we know, is highly symbolic and mystical. That's why he's represented as an eagle taking us to heaven. John's Gospel shows spiritual realities under the surface. It is also highly interested in the sacramental aspect of life. Sacraments, we've all been taught, being outward signs instituted by Christ to give grace, the supernatural grace that is underneath the earthly material elements. John's Gospel shows the sacraments explicitly and explains them boldly. Jesus feeds 5,000 people by multiplying loaves. That's the outward. Then explains what is underneath. I am the bread of life. Eat my flesh. Drink my blood. This seems too strange until we experience it in the Eucharist, where we receive grace in a manner beyond words. The miraculous wine at Cana is a counterpart to those multiplied loaves. Jesus worked these large quantity miracles to send the sacraments down through the centuries. He wanted there to be enough. But there are simpler meanings to the stories, maybe closer to the surface. Going beyond the idea of Jesus as a healer, the Cana story demonstrates a filling of emptiness. that God does supply our needs and ease our burdens, and that God is concerned not only with life versus death or survival, but the quality of that life going far beyond mere survival. They have no wine. The story starts out in poverty, need, and emptiness, which is a very human situation. We may have all of life's necessities, we may even have many luxuries, and still feel dissatisfied or unfulfilled. The story gives voice to that lack, that frustration, through the mouth of Mary, our representative, our spokesperson. They have no wine means they have no wine for us, and we are thirsty. We express our sense of diminishment, our wish for life to bring something more. "What is that to me or you?" Jesus answered. The story has an edge. We expect good manners and gentleness from Jesus, but here he seems quite rude. Instead of a provident father giving our daily bread, as we ask, there are times in life of dryness and famine. How we handle those times is important to the ultimate outcome. Do we get angry? Do we run away discouraged? Or do we somehow continue being present? Do we keep on our feet and stay in the ring so that we are there when the blessing comes? Do whatever he tells you. The mother of Jesus says this to the bridegroom's servants, but she also says it to us. There are, of course, many levels in this simple story. "Do whatever he tells you" is actually what Pharaoh says to the Egyptians when he sets Joseph in authority in the book of Genesis. "Do whatever he tells you to prevent a future famine." In that story, we watch Joseph over time develop from an arrogant, overprivileged youth into wise old age. At the beginning, he brags about being his father's favorite, and the brothers resent him, sell him into slavery, where he is unjustly imprisoned. And of course, he might have died there, but the ordeal becomes an opportunity. When it is time to deal with the famine, Joseph knows what to do, and Pharaoh is right to say, "Do whatever he tells you." "Fill the stone jars to the brim," Jesus says. It is unclear what the jars represent in the story of Cana. They are not really for drinking. They are for Jewish ceremonies of purification. They seem outlandish in size, 50 gallons, I think. But there are only 6, not 7, a number of incompleteness. They may be the outmoded qualities of ancient religion that Jesus knocks over, as if they were so many bowling pins. Perhaps the stoniness of the jars represents the stony hearts which the prophet Ezekiel saw and lamented in Israel. In any case, if the jars represent hearts, our hearts, they should not stay empty. They must be filled to the brim, as the cup in Psalm 23 spills over. Being filled to the brim is a truth we resist when we encounter failure, disappointment, or pain. We want to push that cup, that jar, out of the way. Whereas God often wants us to take it in, even with its bitterness, so that he can make something sweet. This is what Joseph learned from his prison experience. This is what Jesus shows us in accepting the cross. When the servants draw out the liquid, the water has become wine. The central act of transformation happens where we cannot see it. Jesus does not put on a show. He does not stretch out his hands, wave a magic wand, look up to heaven, or say a prayerful word. but the water changes as we ourselves can change and be transformed. We know this, that we have been changed by the effects, even if we cannot pinpoint the moment when it happens. This illuminates the story's phrase, God saves the good wine until last. The best is yet to be is also a truth of the spiritual life. That phrase should put in perspective our episodes of disappointment and struggle. We must not stay stuck in them. I have come, says Jesus, that you may have life, and have life abundantly. He says he will give life abundantly, but not immediately. I looked up Peter Bruegel's genre painting called The Peasant Wedding. In that famous wedding, there are many people and a lot of action. There is much pathos in this painting, for these are peasants who work too hard and age too early. They are having a feast with coarse food, porridge or custard, when they actually deserve much better. And it is wrenching to see how hungry they look. They suck their fingers to get every crumb. It is poignant that the fiddlers who are about to play must wait for their food. They look so hungry. And that a child, we wonder who she belongs to, sits alone on the floor in the lower left of the painting. Just above her, a man is pouring water, not wine, into small stone jars. One of the servers has three legs, and it's not clear who the bridegroom is. Several characters have been proposed in the painting to be the bridegroom, including a dark-clothed man who holds a tankard in each hand, which is very strange. Perhaps a point is being made in this painting, which has been compared to Cana, about Christ, the mysterious bridegroom, whom we want to know yet holds himself apart. A wedding is not about what we eat or drink, but whom we commit to, whom we know. Jesus did this first sign to reveal his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This is a wonderful sentence in which the key words are sign, glory, believe. John is the only New Testament writer to call the miracles of Jesus signs, because, like sacraments and life's meaning, they are not obvious. They represent something. We must trust and allow the meaning to open up and blossom for us. The signs will reveal glory if you are open or receptive, but if you want to scoff or doubt, you are free to do that. Belief in the signs of Jesus will help us through the ordeals of life, especially when our well runs dry. Then God can fill our vessels with lavish abundance. A possible epilogue to the miracle at Cana is the flowing of blood and water, flowing fiercely, profusely, from Jesus' pierced side on the cross. This sign, like the wedding at Cana, is only told by John. It is suggested, perhaps, that blood and water is the best wine, kept till last, as promised in this story. And we say we drink that wine in this Eucharist. We drink from that strange fountain, and it can transform our problematic lives. In the drinking, we experience Jesus' glory. We drink, we believe, we live.